KEXP thanks contributing donors and the Real Networks Foundation for supporting Mind Over Matters.
This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Scott Hueler, author of 6 books, including Defining the Wind and No Man's Lands. Widely published in newspapers nationwide, he has won awards for his work on National Public Radio. Scott Hueler is here today to tell us about his most recent book, On the Grid, A Plot of Land and Average Neighborhood and the Systems That Make Our World Work. Welcome, Scott.
Thanks for having me. I'm so glad to be here.
What led you to write On the Grid?
Well, you know, what led me to write it was an article I did long ago when I lived in Philadelphia. I did a piece about architects, and I interviewed an architect who kind of walked me through a few projects, and he couldn't express strongly enough. He said, everything, somebody thought about it. Somebody was paying attention. The height of the chair rail, the slope of the ceiling. He said, if you swing open a door and then you slap your hand on the wall and there right underneath your hand is the light switch, that architect gets an A for that day. If you swing open a door, walk into the room, slap your hand on the wall, but the light switch is behind the door that you just opened, the architect dropped the ball. He said, you should look at your world paying attention. Somebody thought about all of it. And that ended up getting me thinking about not just the inside and not just the buildings, but all this stuff around. And I was always looking around and thinking, wait a minute, how does that work? And one day when I lived in Nashville, as people like me commonly do, I saw a guy standing up on a bucket truck at a utility pole, and I said, well, what are you doing? And he said, well, we're just, you know, tying another line into the grid. And I had this sudden moment of shocking awareness of the grid. You know, we talk about the grid like it's this conceit, this concept, this thing that we use just to explain something. But no, those wires hanging above the street that I was walking down, that's actually the grid. It's right there. It has physical reality, and it's palpable, and it works, and people do things, and they fix it, and they maintain it, and it exists in physical space. And suddenly I wanted to understand it. And the more I thought about it, the more other things I wanted to think about. And I think what was the final push was here in Raleigh, where I live now, we had a drought of biblical proportions where we were all but out of drinking water. It was kind of a terrifying moment to be here. But all during that drought, you could get out your toothbrush and put on the toothpaste and then turn on the water in your tap and start like humming Pink Floyd, Dark Side of the Moon or something, and just stand there for 40 minutes idly humming, and you would never run out of water. And I thought, how is this possible? How is it possible that in this unbelievable drought, we're totally not out of water? How is it possible that you never run out of electricity? The cable is never down. The telephone always works. All of these systems, it's a constant thing. Somebody's working on them. And so I headed out into the yard and started asking questions.
Well, you've alluded a bit to this, but what do you mean by the grid or infrastructure? What is included?
Well, that's a great question. I include almost everything. Sometimes people talk about the grid and all they mean is electrical power, but I don't think it makes sense to separate the elements of the grid out. You can't have electrical power the way we use it without constant electronic communication, and you can't have it without plentiful fresh water, right? You can't generate electricity without using water in one way or the other. So that's already 3 systems all tied together that you couldn't have one without the other. Try running a water plant without electrical power. You know, try running the internet or a communications utility without tons of electricity. And all of these things are connected. Without the roads and the rails are all required for all of these things to run the way we use them. So I think of it as the electrical grid, the communications facilities, whether it's cable or the airwaves or your cell phone or your landline, the roads, fresh water, wastewater, rail, airports, all the things that tie us together, that literally, that form the net that holds us together, the web that holds us all together.
How well do we in the U.S. take care of our grid or infrastructure?
About as poorly as any supposedly industrial nation does. The statistic that I include in my book and that you hear almost everywhere and that should be terrifying to our citizenry is that the United States spends less than 2.5% of its gross domestic product on maintaining its infrastructure, you know, which would include bridges and roads and, you know, all the stuff that we've been discussing. In Europe, they spend about twice that, and in places like China, where they're really moving forward, they're spending 9% of their GDP on their infrastructure. So if you're wondering why the fastest train in the world just was rolled off the tracks in China, well, that's why, because they're moving forward, and we're fighting our way through city council after city council trying to get, you know, our version of high-speed rail, which might go 120 miles an hour, back on the rails in the United States.
What is the overall state of our infrastructure in the U.S.?
Well, I think that the overall state is that unless we wake up in a big stinking hurry, it's going to fall on our children's heads. In Boston, only a few months ago, they had an enormous water main break that had 2 million people boiling their water before they could drink it for a few days. That's Boston. You know, that's an amazing thing that the system is so fragile that one main break and, you know, half of the metropolitan area is boiling water. And that's just something that should not happen. Not that there aren't going to be main breaks. There are always going to be main breaks. That's the nature of physical reality. But we are not replacing things. The American Society of Civil Engineers gives what it calls report cards for the infrastructure every few years. And most of the systems that they pay attention to, the good systems, the systems that are healthy and safe, they give like C minuses to. Most of them get Ds. Some of them get Fs.
Would you elaborate on our dependence on infrastructure or the grid? Of course, some people talk about getting off the grid. Can we really do that?
Whenever I talk about this, somebody tells me I didn't spend enough time with people getting off the grid. And I say, show me someone who's off the grid, who's really off the grid. I want to see that person. Because what we run into all the time here in the United States is this guy. He downloads plans for an A-frame off the internet, right? And then he drives in his grid-produced car over nice grid-paved roads to Home Depot and buys all of the wood that he needs to go out and build it. And then he drives up these beautifully maintained infrastructures and drives up to his 14 acres next to a national forest, which is managed by about three layers of grid-produced, grid-supported government to keep the land safe and the water pure. And then he builds his house with a septic tank and a pump and a windmill to power them, and he gets his internet and his cable TV off of a grid-managed and grid-produced satellite and stands there and says, look at me, I'm off the grid. It's almost sad to me that you could convince yourself that just because you're not buying the electricity that's running your microwave today, that that means somehow that all of these other things that you're using were not grid-produced things. You can use less power, and we should. We must. It's vital that we learn how to get by with less, that we use less, that we waste less. We should all be having windmills in our yards and solar panels and saving electricity and saving water and all of these vital things that we're frying our planet in its own petroleum-based oils, right? So we should change our behavior. But the grid itself, getting off the grid, I think is wrong-headed thinking. What we need to do is fix the grid so that it's there to support us, improve it with things like the smart grid, with conservation, so that we're using it better and taking better care of it. But the grid is one of the greatest advances. I call it in the book the eighth wonder of the world. And it's one of the greatest things that humankind has ever created, this mesh that connects us, that I can hit a bunch of buttons sitting at my desk and see or listen to or talk to just about anything or anyone on the planet. This is nothing short of miraculous. And to decide, okay, I don't want that, I just don't understand that. I love to go camping too, but to say I'm fine without that, what I finally say is that I'll believe that you're really off the grid if when your kid gets sick, you don't want grid-produced antibiotics for your kid. Then you're really off the grid. But until I hear that, I don't really believe it. I don't think you can pick and choose which elements of the grid you choose to participate in.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Scott Hewler, author of the book On the Grid, A Plot of Land, An Average Neighborhood, and the Systems That Make Our World Work. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. In Raleigh, North Carolina, where you live, the city banned garbage disposals. Why did they do this, and how do garbage disposals affect the infrastructure that serves us?
Well, garbage disposals affect the infrastructure in five different ways, in my opinion. And I'll have more to say about this. I've heard from the incinerator people, of course. They have a different perspective than mine, and I'll share their perspective that I've heard as well. When Raleigh banned garbage disposals, the reason it did that was because we were having sanitary sewer overflows. And the reason they were having sanitary sewer overflows was because fat and oil was going into the sewer system, into the wastewater system, and that stuff blocks up and does terrible things to the system, and then it boils over. And so my claim is that when you use a garbage disposal, it's affecting five infrastructure systems. It's using power that you could get along without using, because if you didn't have it, it wouldn't be running those kilowatt hours. It's using fresh water, which you're pouring down the drain while you're using it, and which certainly you could do without. And as we learned in our drought, fresh water is far from a limitless resource. It is affecting the wastewater system because it's clogging it up with food waste and fat, especially the fat from the food waste. And it is affecting the storm sewers. When those sanitary sewer overflows come out, what they do is find, you know, water flows downhill, so they find their way into the stormwater systems, and they pollute them, and then the people have to go and clean them up. So kind of everywhere you look at it, a garbage disposal is at best using, at worst abusing some system. And the fifth system that it affects is solid waste, which is that there's materials that could be in landfills generating methane gas, which provides power, or better yet, they could be in your mulch pile in the backyard of your house, you know, fertilizing your soil. So that's five different systems. Now, I should point out that the people at InSinkErator have reached out to me and expressed most strongly that they think that the amount of fresh water that is used is minimal, and the same thing with the amount of power, and also that there are sewage plants that love to get the food waste and use it to generate their own power. I've discussed it with the people that I know in Raleigh who manage the systems, and what they tell me is that, by and large, wastewater treatment plants who are running anaerobic systems, which is very complicated, we won't get into it right now, would love that food waste, but they like to get it delivered by truck. They really don't want to have it coming down their pipes, and it really does clog pipes. That's the fundamental issue, is that putting the food waste down pipes with the fat in it clogs pipes. I couldn't find anybody outside of InSinkErator who wanted to dispute that. So my point isn't so much that the garbage disposal is a terrible thing. And certainly here in Raleigh, when the city council tried to ban them, the city went insane and went mad for about a month and a half, and everybody backed away and said, forget it, forget it, forget it. Just use your garbage disposals. My point isn't so much that the garbage disposal is a terrible thing. My point is that even this little tiny garbage disposal, this thing that you don't think about from one year to the next, affects so many other things, parts of your life, and it's all connected, and you really need to know about that. And the garbage disposal, to me, is a wonderful metaphor for how we treat our infrastructure, which is that mostly we ignore it, and we use it in ways for which it was not designed, and then when it breaks, we complain, and we don't want to spend any money to get it to be fixed.
In your book, you investigate how water, electricity, and other infrastructure connect from your home to the main community systems. What did you find? What would be an example or two?
Wow, that's exactly right. That's what I did, is every one of these systems, whether it was water or wastewater or electricity or the roads, I started in my house. And I said, well, okay, here's this thing stuck on the back of my house that makes my house look like something out of a science fiction movie, right? And then if, like, I'm part of the hive mind from the Borg on Star Trek or something, and then you follow the wires up and you can see where it goes into the distribution lines for the electrical system, and then you can see where the distribution lines go back to the substation, and then the substation connects to the transmission lines, and the transmission lines, you can follow them all the way down. You know, you can just get on Google Maps and you can follow it all the way back to the generation plant. in my case, a nuclear plant. And it's an amazing thing. First of all, I never even knew that there were distribution lines and transmission lines, that there were these different kinds of electrical lines, nor did I even know, in fact, that there are primary and secondary distribution. It's so complex what's going on there. But what was thrilling to me was to just start in each place, you know, and follow and say, how does it get to my house, and see which substation it got to and how it got there, and have people explain, well, here's the voltage that we're stepping it down to, and here's how that works, and here's why that works, and here's what a transformer hanging on the utility pole does. And when people say the transformers were exploding, they're always wrong. They think they're exploding. What they're not, what you hear is fuses going off, and they're designed to pop so that the transformers don't explode. And just all these little things that we talk about as if we know, the goal for me was to, at the very least, understand how much I didn't know. My goal, my hope had been at the end of this book to be almost like a sort of Peterson's guide and be able to walk around and anything somebody pointed out to me, look up at the wire and say, oh, I know what kind of junction box that is, and I know what it's connecting, and I know which systems and where it goes to. Of course, that never happened. There's so much going on, and I could never have it all in my head at once. And in fact, you know, I'd be driving around with the guys from the cable companies or the guys from the electrical companies, and I'd point up to something and I'd say, well, what's that? And they'd say, hold on, let me make a phone call. And I thought, you know, if they don't know every single thing that they see, I shouldn't have to know it either to feel like I got somewhere. But it was powerfully enlightening to understand exactly where my electricity came from, or where the water treatment plant was, or how we could have two water treatment plants at different ends of our water system here in Raleigh, and, you know, they work together. It's not like a tree and just branches getting smaller and smaller, which is what I naturally assumed it would be in all of these systems, but they almost never are. They're almost all looping systems that the signal or the power or the water can find many different ways to get to your house if it needs to, so that, as the people at the utilities told me, if we dig up the water main south of your house, you'll probably still get water. It'll just come from north of your house. If we dig it up north of your house, you'll probably still get it from south of your house. It's much more like a road than like a tree with smaller and smaller branches.
You are listening to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Scott Hewler, author of the book On the Grid, A Plot of Land, an Average Neighborhood, and the Systems That Make Our World Work. What observations did you make about the people who maintain our infrastructure?
By the time I was done with this book, you would constantly hear me saying, thank God for the engineers, because that's who I was hanging around with. I was hanging around with people who could understand systems of such complexity and who could manage them, and that for me to even understand it well enough to write it down, then I would have to get up the next morning and reread what I had written in order to understand it again. It's so complicated, some of these things. And these people keep it going. You know, imagine, try to think about the percentage of time that you have electrical power, or you have your cable, or you have your water, or your sewer, or any of these systems. They're up virtually all the time. They never fail in any meaningful way. And that's unimaginable, and yet they keep them going. And that stretches down not just to the degreed engineers up at the top of the food chain. I mean the people who are out there. I spent some time with the guys who clean out the sewer clogs and stuff like that. And I saw one guy, they have a special long, like 16-foot shovel with a curved edge on it they call a spoon. It's got holes in it to drop water, but you can pull out gravel that's got stuck in there, or, you know, some kind of clog, the grease that they're always finding in there, things like that. And they sort of hand over hand it down into these manholes and then have to very carefully balance it and pull it back up. And I saw a guy doing that one time, and he just turned to me and he said, you know, and people think it's Tidy Bowl that keeps their bathrooms clean. And I thought, that's so true. That's exactly right, is that it's guys like this guy out there 24/7 cleaning up sanitary sewer overflows whenever they happen, in the middle of the night, in the middle of the winter, in the middle of a rainstorm, and taking care of business. It's guys like that that make it so easy for the rest of us to live. And I just ended up with such gratitude for the people. They think of themselves as public health professionals. They don't think, I'm going out to bust my knuckles on a water pipe today and go home stinky and smelly and muddy and have to take a shower. They don't think, oh, I have this junky job at the water system. They think of themselves as public health professionals, and they're right. Without clean water, we're nowhere. So just to watch these people at work, it was kind of a privilege for me. I really felt grateful by the end of it.
How well are U.S. citizens likely to be able to respond if our infrastructure fails?
I would say we're almost not likely to be able to respond at all. Think about it. I spoke with one of the superintendents of the wastewater system here in Raleigh, and he openly worried about it. He said, you know, he grew up in one of the counties out here, and every year you dug a big hole and you picked up the outhouse from over last year's hole and you put it on top of the new hole and you took the dirt that you dug from the hole and you put it over last year's outhouse, and then you've got another year's worth of waste solutions, and you know how far that has to be from where you're getting your water and how far it has to be from any stream or anything like that, and you're just aware of that kind of thing. And he said, if our system failed tomorrow, I don't think anybody would know what to do. And he really sort of conjured up this image of citizens wandering the streets holding rolls of toilet paper with worried expressions on their faces, wondering what they were supposed to do. And I truly think that's where we'd be. I don't think we have any sense, the average citizen, especially the average city dweller, which is, you know, the enormous majority of us, would have any real sense of how to manage things like getting and taking care of fresh water and getting rid of and managing wastewater and how to power our homes, how to heat our homes, how to do any of the things we would need to do if these systems crashed.
In your view, how much do average citizens need to know about our infrastructure?
I think they need to know enough that they can happily take out their wallets and start spending the money it's going to take to fix them. I think that if you're really willing to listen, you can't fail to understand the centrality and importance of these systems, the fundamental human reality that you can't get anything without paying for it. It's just that doesn't happen. People are so confused about taxes. The last chapter of my book is an overt love letter to taxes. Here in Raleigh, before we had roads, before there were roads, there was an overseer of roads in 1792 when the city was founded. And he had the ability to come and knock on your door. Knock, knock, wake up. It's road day. You're elected. Come with me. Bring a shovel. You owed the city several days per year of road maintenance. Because it was a city, you were part of the community, you were obligated to be part of keeping it going. Now, you could pay your way out of it and send someone else. Well, that's what we all do now. We pay taxes and have somebody else and go and pave the roads for us because we don't want to. But I think that's a great system. Taxes isn't the government putting its hand in your pocket. First of all, we're the government. In the second place, taxes are the best and most convenient way of getting those roads paved. And that's what I think people need to know about their infrastructure, is that it exists, it's real, it's functioning constantly, and it costs money. And if you pretend to yourself that it should be free or that you don't owe that money or somehow you can go off the grid and therefore not have to pay for it, you're kidding yourself. But I think we should understand that these systems are real, that they function constantly, that costs money, and we haven't been taking care of them, and that we've got to take care of them. I think that my goal in writing this book was to wake people up to what's happening around them. I keep telling people I didn't want to be Al Gore and say, if you don't screw in these curly light bulbs tomorrow, the Greenland ice sheet, like snow off a pitched roof, and we're all going to drown. And I didn't want to be Dick Cheney and say, just shut up and keep buying gasoline. I wanted to say, over the next 50 years, all of these systems are going to need an enormous amount of attention from you and from your cities and your counties and your states and the nation and the world. They're all going to need an enormous amount of attention from you. You should be sufficiently educated about them to be able to participate sensibly in the discussions about what needs to happen.
From the research you did in your book, what parts of our infrastructure are most in need of improvement?
I think right now, so much attention is being given to the grid that I'm not too worried about it, because I think that people would panic so quickly if the grid failed. so that I think that people will be paying attention to the grid. And plus, things about like the smart grid to help manage electrical power, help use less, help people be able to generate their own and still be on the grid, things like that, I think are happening. I think that that's moving forward. I'm happy about that. I would say that it's almost counterintuitively, it's the fresh water and the wastewater systems that people are not paying close attention to, especially. And that's because they're underground. The problem with the infrastructure is that it's so infra. It's just under. It's beneath. We don't notice it. And you keep turning on your faucet and water keeps coming out. That means it's all good. And you don't really realize how troubled your system is or how long it's been since anybody really did a total upgrade on the system and how expensive that is.
What do you see as the greatest challenges in maintaining and improving an infrastructure that will successfully service in the future?
I had a great traffic engineer speak with me when I was in Raleigh. We were sitting at a very complicated intersection, and bicyclists and buses and cars and pedestrians, everybody was almost killing each other and all kinds of crazy things were going on. And I said, what are the things that as a traffic engineer, as a transportation engineer, that are never out of your mind? What are the things that never leave you? And I was thinking, okay, speed versus safety or convenience versus velocity or stopping distance. I'm thinking asphalt and concrete. What is he going to tell me? And he said, there are two things that I never stop thinking about, money and political will. He said, those are the two things. Person after person, as I worked on this book, told me the same thing. There is not a single technical challenge for our infrastructure that we can't face. Most of them we already have faced. We have the technology. Even things like electrical cars and the smart grid, we're making our way. We're making our way. We're going to get there technologically. But are we going to be willing to pay for it? Do we have the political will to face the unpleasant reality that over the last 50 years, we've just been running up a credit card bill? And sooner or later, we've got to pay that credit card bill. And we can either do it ourselves or let it be our kids and grandkids who do it. And I hope that we have the courage, the political will, to spend the money and say, let's do this. Let's make this our legacy, that we improve these systems so that they'll take care of our children rather than our children will have to take care of them.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Stand outside, and it's not just fabulous and worth having because it keeps your lights on. See the beauty in it. Try to look at, you know, a big transmission pylon in your neighborhood the same way that you would look at a blue jay or a bluebird nest. Say, oh, that's great. We have a bluebird nest in our yard. What a fun summer this is going to be to watch the bluebirds. Well, what a fun thing to see these systems that are just miraculous functioning around you every day. I keep pointing to these enormous transmission pylons that we all look at as some sort of blight on the landscape and say, if the Eiffel Tower is beautiful, how is this not beautiful? This is part of how we function. This is part of the world we've made for ourselves. And we should be festooning these things with lights and painting them in beautiful colors and running pathways beneath them so that our kids ride their bicycles there. This infrastructure that we have is a miracle. And I think if we looked at it as, instead of an ugly necessity that we have to grit our teeth and pay for once in a while, as a wonderful, miraculous accomplishment that we should be singing hosannas to, I think that might help us get in the right frame of mind to address our infrastructure.
Well, thanks so much for being with us, Scott.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You have just been listening to Scott Hewler, author of the book On the Grid, A Plot of Land, An Average Neighborhood, and the Systems That Make Our World Work, published in 2010 by Rodale Incorporated. For more information, check on the web at www.scotthewler.com. Again, that's ScottHewler.com. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and kexp.org.